You're listening to DraftKings Network.
Today's episode is brought to you by The Bike Riders, a new film from Jeff Nichols starring Jodie Comer, Austin Butler, and Tom Hardy. Inspired by true events, The Bike Riders follows Benny, played by Austin Butler, the newest member of Midwestern motorcycle club The Vandals, led by the enigmatic Johnny, played by Tom Hardy. Critics are calling it electrifying, stunning, exhilarating, powerful, and the godfather of biker movies. Experience The Bike Riders on the big screen this summer. Now playing only in theaters. Visit BikeRidersMovie.com to get tickets now.
It's the Cooligans, stupid.
The World Cup is upon us.
Uh-huh. It is. It has arrived. It has. We've already experienced it. Okay. And now we got to move through the awkwardness of this World Cup.
And the awkwardness started right away, baby. There's no opening ceremony that's never not awkward, right?
If it's not cringe, did he really do an opening ceremony?
Bruh, it's got to be like, let's just get all the local dancing schools together, as much fabric and fireworks as possible, and see what happens. And that's kind of what this was. This was another one of those things where I'm like, there's a lot of interpretive dance happening here, and I'm not really sure how to interpret it.
Okay. Something's lost in translation.
Okay.
What is good, everybody? Welcome to the Cooligans World Cup Daily. If you are new here,
it's the Cooligans, buddy.
It is the Cooligans, buddy. We are here. We are part of the Levitard and Friends Network. We are going to be with you throughout the entire World Cup. And this episode is brought to you by AutoZone. Get in the zone, AutoZone. My name is Christian Polanco.
I'm Alexis Guerreros.
Okay. And Alexis, we are both in the same room.
Yeah, that's why we rented a studio, so that we'd both be there.
We did a whole thing in preparation for this exact moment, and Alexis is not in the room right now.
I'm not really, buying into the whole idea of us being in the same room, even though it was my idea. I came up a little over a week ago, and I was like, I'm fine. I'm sure it's nothing. And it turns out I was not fine, and it was something.
Yes, you got hit with the Rona.
Yo, bruh, and I was like, damn, I was trying to order a beer, my G. you gave me the wrong one. Worst part is
what I ordered.
Gave it to my lady, bro. She was working in hospitals all 2 years. Nothing. 2 years and 8 months to the day of the lockdown. Nothing. Yeah. And then boom.
Turned out you're patient zero. Crazy.
Yo. You can avoid it in a hospital, but you can't avoid it from a fat, sweaty husband sleeping next to you, apparently.
But no, I'm glad to see that you are feeling better and you're getting out of that because, yeah, I mean, yeah, it's a bummer that you're not here, but,
I'm good. Today I'm feeling, thank you, and today I'm feeling a lot better, and obviously I didn't make you sick, which is a big relief because you've got a pregnant lady at home. I was very, very worried about that, but I'm feeling much, much better today. I'm good today. Past 2 days have felt way more normal. The only problem is it was just right on that line. Today's the 10th day, or yesterday was the 10th day, where I'm like, if I'm hanging out with you, plus my lady is sick, it would have been like, it's a little pushing it, plus we got to get to Atlanta for tomorrow. Yeah, there was a lot happening. So I'm like, you know what? For today, I'm going to just watch this from home. And the whole time it was my wife with a stuffed nose going, the hell are you watching? Because it was like I said, it was Morgan Freeman speaking to someone who looked like he was asking himself questions.
Well, look, the opening ceremony started. Yes. Morgan Freeman, who is a voice pretty much in every film, in every interview.
You want to know how much he is? He was the voice on our bid, the USA bid for this World Cup.
Yeah. So they brought him back. This was the remix, the Qatar remix.
They're like, yo, you boys lost, but we'll pay you.
But Morgan Freeman is always like the voice of reason, the voice of, there's a certain wisdom that comes with, you know, everything he says. And so it felt like, I mean, what? That's a good person to hire to introduce a World Cup that where some people may not be happy with where the World Cup is happening.
Funny enough, too, every time he spoke, regardless of what, he hasn't said anything yet. The moment his voice starts, the crowd would applaud because he's a superstar. It's Morgan Freeman.
Without a doubt.
The Penguins, the March of the Penguins, bruh. You know?
Okay.
It's incredible.
How you know him?
I mean, that's kind of what put his voiceover career on the map.
Yeah, I guess so. But, you know.
No, not I Glory, guess so. It's for real.
Shawshank Redemption. He's won. Yeah, no, Oscars
he's been in great films. He's been in great films. But March of Penguins, bro.
March of Penguins, obviously. That's on top. That's the first thing we always think of. But no, so the World Cup kicked off, and there was a controversy even before the opening ceremony even started, because everybody's trying to handle and try to figure out how they're gonna cover this World Cup and broadcast it. You know, Fox, they're doing their thing. You know, we have, you know, people, analysts and friends and they're doing their thing. They're just treating it like this is any other World Cup. But if you watch the BBC, they were like, bro, yeah. as soon as they didn't show the opening ceremony on BBC. They also, Gary Lineker opened the broadcast basically saying like, yo, World Cup has a lot of problems. Yeah, we're covering it, highlighting all the human rights issues and human rights abuses. And it angered some people because they feel like that's not the way it should have been covered, or they feel like there's some hypocrisy there. But, it, you know, World Cups usually don't start like this, is my main point.
I mean, look, two things. They're going to say, well, England lost. You know, they lost the bid. Remember, don't forget, Beckham was part of their bid. It was a lot of fanfare. There was a lot of expectation that it would be USA and England that would win this. So maybe there's some sour grapes in the way it's being covered. But also, hey, there's a lot of reasons why you want to cover it this way. You know, we've talked about it before. I know, Gary Neville's like, what are you talking about? Three people died. That's it. That's what I was paid to say. And that's what I'm going to say. So I get that. You know what I mean? I get that there's that sentiment, but there's also a lot of reasons why. And look, this has been brought up. This isn't the only World Cup that's ever had its fair share of controversies. But I would say this is the first World Cup that's been kind of granted or won and built and put on through the social media era. So a lot of these things are brought to light way more than, what was it, 1978 Argentina. We ain't worried about 1978 Argentina, bro. That already happened. This one is probably the most controversial. And there was still a lot of controversy around Russia as well. But this one is probably the most controversial. So some people are going to take that tact. I understand people saying like, hey, man, let's not turn this into a political thing. Yeah. Let's just enjoy a competition. But BBC was like, what if we do the exact opposite?
Just real lean in, okay,
bro. What if we remind everyone of the atrocities right off the rip?
Earlier, because I was watching the game here with some friends. Shout out to everybody who came through. But I got asked this question, like essentially, like from a sentimental standpoint, how do you feel about this World Cup? And my answer was essentially the way I feel about like NWSL. Where NWSL, especially in the last year, has had a lot of controversy, a lot of real issues that are very, very upsetting. And I think about the tweet from, I think it was Bixby, right, for the Thorns goalkeeper. And she basically said, she's aware of everything that's going on, but she put out a plea to the fans saying, like, hey, we need the fans at our playoff game. Like, it just won't be the same without the fans there. And that's kind of how I feel about this World Cup, where there's a lot of controversy surrounding it, and I'm trying to support the players, because the players don't decide where the World Cup is played. It's not up to them. This is it's still very much a dream to play in this tournament for a lot of people that are there, a lot of people that we know that are playing in it. And that's where my heart is. I'm like, I'm just going to support these players and hope for their success. Because all the political stuff outside of it is, of course, something that should be addressed. But the positive that I'm taking out of it is that, you know, especially for the U.S. men's national team, this is their first World Cup for a lot of those guys there. So I'm just trying to be happy and supportive about that.
Everyone except Yedlin. This is their first World Cup.
Correct. Correct. You know?
How crazy is that?
Yeah, because DeAndre Yedlin is the DeMarcus Beasley of the 2022 USMNT roster.
Actually, somehow it's Tim Ream at 35 years old gets his first World Cup.
Yeah.
That's not what we're talking about. But you know what? What you did remind me there is that we have friends in the World Cup now. That's probably the most important thing. How crazy is that?
Why aren't they highlighting that?
Yo, BBC, you got all this extra time if you're not doing the opening ceremonies, bro. Why don't you talk about the real news, which is the Cooligans have homies?
Why don't you highlight the fact that Matt Turner follows us on Instagram, okay?
Bro, and DMs us back, bro.
All right.
Sean Johnson, the homie.
Man.
I talk cars.
So the World Cup did kick off with Qatar versus Ecuador. They rescheduled this match. Remember, they wanted Qatar wanted their own day,
And they got it
for this.
Gianni Infantino said no, and they did it. Then Gianni Infantino said, "You can't stop selling Budweiser at the game," and they did it. And then, but we didn't even talk about Gianni Infantino's super weird conference.
Oh, that's right. The today I feel gay.
Conference. Today I feel black. Today I feel a migrant worker. And he said he understands discrimination because he was a redhead with freckles. But the man has both no hair or freckles left. So discrimination over, bro.
A long time ago. Yo, you lying? I think we're being catfished by Johnny Infantino, bro.
Yo, so you look like a movie villain now, but the movie villain you used to look like was the Chucky doll? That's what you told me.
Bro, I don't know, dude. I don't know I don't know where I'm swiping on this dude because this is
I'm confused, bro. Yeah, it was odd. And at first I thought like, oh, he must be doing this to kind of throw it in the Qataris' faces for them switching up the whole Budweiser thing. And the rumor is that he's sort of lost control of this tournament, that Qataris now control it, which isn't supposed to happen. It's supposed to be a FIFA event. And I thought that's where it was going. But then he used it to say, like, this is why you shouldn't discriminate against the Qataris.
Yeah. I mean,
it was so confusing.
There's been so much of the, you know, journalists trying to film in certain places. There's friends of ours that are trying to just like take video or and photograph in around Doha and do their jobs. Like, and
here we are today standing outside. Nope, we're going to jail. Sorry.
So, you know, you see like Qatari officials or police officers telling people like, yo, you can't film here and all this other stuff. And that's how it is. Like, you know, this is not new, this tactic of like, oh, no, you know what? Give us the World Cup. Don't worry about it. Everything's going to be fine. Yeah, you know, whatever. Like, beer? Beer, come on. What's a country without beer? What's a World Cup without beer? And then 2 days before the World Cup.
We got beer. We just ain't going to let you buy it. But we got it.
We got it. We didn't say, you didn't say anything about buying it. We have it.
You said you want to consume it. There was that thing. I should have heard that.
They highlighted that point that so beer is not available at the stadiums, but they are in like the luxury suites, which are like 19,000 euros per ticket or something like that. Like whatever. I mean, it is what it is, bro. Like if you're not part of the wealthy elite, you can't even have a sip of the Budweiser. They're not even giving you a little bit of it,
which is kind of ironic when you think about it.
It's incredible. So that seems to be leading up to the first match today. Hearing all these stories about journalists getting stopped from doing their jobs and the beer not being available at stadiums, and it was just all popped up a couple days before the tournament. And it just leads to just more examples of why, obviously, the World Cup probably shouldn't be there. Maybe this is some sort of lesson for the future.
Probably not.
It's
not a lesson. No one's gonna
be mad at.
Ain't no one gonna learn from this, bro. They're gonna get paid again. I do have a question for you, though. Did it kind of, because the World Cup isn't starting with like multiple matches in one day, and you know, there's all this sort of additional stuff that you have to sort of consider before even watching it. Did it feel different for you? Did you enjoy it less?
I don't think it had anything to do with not being multiple matches. I mean, I think the heavy-handedness of like the opening ceremony, of like the constantly preaching unity and respect, and we're all different tribes that are here to learn from each other. I'm like, all right, I mean, I get what you're doing. It's not, right. It's, you know, you can't hide this. I mean, the criticism I think is fair of everything going on in the World Cup. And just like Infantino's press conference, where he's basically just pleading with everybody, like, stop criticizing Qatar. The World Cup is here. It was decided 12 years ago. Let's just basically go move on with our lives and do what we got to do. And it's right. The World Cup is not just going to wrap up with like, wow, Qatar, what a beautiful city. We didn't know about this city and we didn't know about this country. And look how cool it is. How they put on, it shouldn't just be a PR tourism board, you know, or campaign for Qatar. Like, there's fair criticism. And he has to deal with it. I mean, I don't know how much involved he was in the world. He wasn't the FIFA president at the time.
No.
But you can't just be like, stop criticizing Qatar. That cannot be the move, and that's not a good representation of the president of FIFA.
I mean, it reminds me of when my mother would like pull me out of like a family party and she'd be like, look, we don't like these people either. OK, but we have to be at this party. And then if you're good, we'll leave and go to McDonald's. OK, but for now, can you just please just put a smile on and get through the event? And that's kind of, it's like two families who don't like each other and their children are marrying. And one of them's name is Alexis and the other one is Donna. No. This is kind of like, let's just get through the reception, bro. All right. Yeah.
So let's talk about the game real quick. Obviously, Qatar did lose to Ecuador. I don't have an Ecuador kit, but I'm rocking my Colombia kit because it's the closest thing I have, right?
And all Ecuador, their flags are the same color.
Ecuador was La Gran Colombia at one point. So Ecuador dominant. Eden Valencia's gets two goals, and I the weird thing to me, and I think we spoke about this on the show. I don't know if it was you or somebody else. I think Ecuador is going to do fairly well in this World Cup. And for some reason, some people don't think they were because of the you know, they play in CONMEBOL and blah, blah, blah. They only play the same teams or whatever. But the same teams are Brazil, Argentina, Uruguay, Colombia, the gigantic, absolute powerhouses.
The teams everyone else fears are the teams they have to constantly play. But also, I mean, you got to see how strong defensively they were. I think they're the third best defensive team in the tournament. So they're clearly to be feared. And if you got Ener Valencia, this dude will score onside, offside, upside, downside, bro. Dude, yeah. This dude will score.
Goals that were turned back or taken back by VAR, which I thought were fair. I think there was one that was a little bit controversial, but I don't think it was going to make much of a difference. My main takeaway from this game was Qatar is bad. And they played in the Gold Cup. And that's when, you know, I saw them for the first time. And they were pretty good in the Gold Cup, but maybe against CONCACAF competition, maybe that's sort of the level that they're at. But they looked, I wouldn't say that they just simply looked bad. I would say that they looked nervous. And you noticed it with like, they were losing the ball, taking two. When they were going 1v1, they were just like taking heavy touches and giving up the ball fairly easily. Again, Ecuador is Ecuador. They're very good, and Qatar could barely create any real chance. There wasn't really any real stretch of time where I felt that they were in this game, and I thought Ecuador was going to win like 4-5-0. So I was surprised that it only ended up 2-0.
Yeah, I thought it was pretty obviously, you know, look, Ecuador was very clearly doing what it does. And I think Qatar never really established who they are, what they do. You know, from everything we saw, they were going to do the, you know, defend in a low block, try to counter. Their best scorer, I think, has something like 8 goals in international competition. recently. I'm not exactly sure the stat. I don't know why I even started talking about it, but I know their best score isn't necessarily like, you know, not the greatest score on earth. You know, it's not like they have like a diamond in the midfield either. There's nothing there that says like, this is how we're going to play, is we're going to get the ball to this guy, or this guy's going to unlock the defense. But what I saw in the Gold Cup was that when they get the ball, they can maintain possession. They can, at the very least, spring an attack. And we saw none of that. I think it was the whole entire first half, they didn't have a shot at all. It was just, it was rough. It was an embarrassment, really, when you think about it. This being the first game you're playing in front of your nation as a host of a World Cup, that was kind of embarrassing.
It was not a good idea to reschedule the whole tournament to start with just them, because I knew this is what it was going to be. There's no way that, Ecuador, maybe they underestimated it. Maybe it was just like a good financial opportunity to have them have their own game. The host nation have their first game. They were just bad. I mean, I don't think I don't think anybody is surprised by this result, but seeing the Qatari people in the stands when the camera's cutting to them and then just head in their hands, they're just like, for whatever reason, the emotion, and, you know, people were making this claim that they hired like fake fans from different countries and to support, and like, if that's real or not, sure, I don't know.
I didn't get a call. I would have happy been rooting for Qatar, bro. How much money?
But when they would cut to, I don't know what the clothing is called, that the garb that they wear. But when it was cutting to them and they were like, you know, miserable about it, just looks like a Middle Eastern prince who just lost money in FTX. You know what I mean? Like, they just, it seems like it's not that just Qatar is losing, it's that it's hurting them financially that they're losing. It's just, it's hard to like connect emotionally exactly with who is involved in Qatar from a financial perspective and who's involved in Qatar from like as a nationalistic pride perspective.
Right. I look, at the end of the day, you got your own day, but oof, that result is not what you wanted. And the thing is, it's not like you lost in the last second. It's not like they won momentum in the 70th, but you had 70 minutes where you showed your country, you know, could play well. Bro, it was an embarrassment from the moment you started. Your goalkeeper looked like he was told what a goalkeeper should do moments before the game.
Which is weird, because they looked really good in Gold Cup.
Were they different players in Gold Cup? Like, what happened?
Well, I don't know. It seemed like a lot of the same dudes, but
it didn't look this bad.
19? When was that? 20?
Might be 2020.
2021. That was last year, right?
Yeah.
Okay. There was a Gold Cup in 2019 as well. There obviously are every 2 years. But yeah, it was just like they had no shot. I think from the beginning, when the goal got turned back 3 minutes in, you got the sense that Ecuador was serious about this and that the quality was just a little bit too high for Qatar. So that's day one of the World Cup. Definitely not without its share of controversy and stories, and you know what, and at the very least, a pretty entertaining game. I thought the game was a lot more, it was more fun than I expected it to be. It wasn't a pitcher's duel, everybody playing defensive. Both teams were just like, yo, let's just do this and let's have a good time. And Ecuador definitely showed out. Okay, we have an interview today. That we got to get to. Clint Smith, we posted on Patreon the full extended interview, but so we have Clint Smith with us in a moment. And Clint Smith is an author, the New York Times bestselling author. He is a poet. He is friends with Aaron West also. But a great dude. He wrote an incredible book. And you'll hear more about it, but I want to make sure I mention Clint is writing a newsletter throughout the World Cup for The Atlantic, so please go check that out. Just Google Clint Smith, The Atlantic, you'll find it. I already read his first piece, and it's awesome. So please go check that out and have a listen. Check out our conversation with author Clint Smith.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
All right, I am excited for today's
show. This is an
honor. This is an absolute honor because we are joined by a New York Times best-selling author, which we
it's look, crazy.
It's pretty crazy. We usually
on
don't
our
get...
show, a poet is about to be on our show.
There are people that are tuning in right now, and they're honestly going to be like, "Yo, why is he talking to these dudes?" That's
Yo, he needs to fire his publicist.
But not only do we have a best-selling author and poet, I think he's also most well-known for being Aaron West's friend. So yeah, this is pretty
top
cool.
Top of the resume, for sure.
First line. But we are joined and honored to have Clint Smith. Thank you for joining us, man.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here. Aaron probably didn't tell you the story about how, you know, it's wild because, you know, yesterday I watched him on Paramount Plus, and he was like a commentator, a pundit on an Arsenal game. And we, you know, when I met Aaron, I was 17. He was, I guess, 19. I was being recruited by Davidson College.
Which is where he went. Maybe, that's right.
Which is where he went. Steph Curry is our claim to fame. For those who confuse us otherwise with Dickinson or Denison or any of those other D liberal arts schools, but he brought me. He was the person I stayed with on my recruiting visit.
Oh wow!
And so it's like it's just wild to see the way that he is. You know, we used to sit in the locker room because that's the only place back in 2005, 2006 that would get. You know, Fox Sports or Fox Soccer, the Fox Soccer channel,
Fox Soccer could, Plus,
where you could watch the English Premier League games, and so we could all go to the locker room and like watch Arsenal, and now this man is on TV getting paid to talk about Arsenal. It's unreal,
isn't it crazy? Wearing a turtleneck, a sweater, wearing and chains on the outside,
gold chains,
turtleneck Bruh. And chain, bro.
Man. He looks like he's about to introduce the newest bootleg iPhone.
He's ready.
Yeah, absolutely incredible.
The glow up is real for both of you because I was looking up. You know, on Twitter, I searched Clint Smith and Aaron West to see what the communication is like publicly. And there's when you tweeted about being number one on the New York Times bestseller list, he tweeted, "I don't even have a roast. I'm just happy for you." I'm like, wow. That must mean that the roast must be so severe that he has to highlight that he is not roasting you.
There's one day of the year that I don't get roasted in the group chat, and that was when I was number one New York Times bestseller. But the next day, they went right back to it. They were like, right, "This is a holiday. This is a reprieve for you." Right. And then afterwards, you know, you gotta have the homies who keep you humble. So
yes,
very much so. So
they will remind you wore that shirt that one time forever.
Don't look. I thought you were gonna say you were looking up pictures of us from when we were. College kids, which you shouldn't do that. It was a mess.
Yeah, I've already seen a couple, and I'll probably add them in post. But I'll look because I've seen a couple of them posted. But you guys had a look, an image of the time. You know what
I mean? I mean, it was the time of like triple XL tall tees.
I was about to say, were y'all counting stacks in your white tees? Damn, in my white tees.
Yeah, clearly we went hard at Davidson College. It was a wild
sponsored
a wild
by
time.
Galaxy Tees. Let's go. If you want them good quality, you got to get Galaxy, bro. Right.
So I want to get started by we have to talk about your book. It is incredible. I did read the book, and you know, like a lot of people, have said this, but I was absolutely floored. I mean, there is
for those of you who don't know what book we're talking about is How the Word Is Passed.
Yes.
It's a very powerful book. Number one bestseller.
Right.
Huge.
So, but, So I want to make sure. So I just want to give my impression of it, because there is a little bit of, you know, I think so. I'm Dominican. Alexis is Cuban, and so we're both born here, but our connection to Black history or African American history might be a little bit different, coming from a Caribbean sort of perspective. So when I read books like this, I tend to learn a lot because I was not informed of a lot of this information. But I think the first impression was your chapter. It's one of the early chapters about Thomas Jefferson, right? And the how slavery was viewed at the time, and how people kind of operated under, like, yeah, it's bad, but that's how things kind of are. You know what I mean? So I want to talk about when you were doing your research for the book and kind of hearing about all these specifics and these perspectives. What was your take on what people thought of slavery at the time?
Yeah, I mean, it might be helpful to give a sort of a little bit of background about the book. So as you said, the book is called How the Word Is Passed, A Reckoning with the History of Slavery Across America. And it started in 2017. When I was watching several Confederate statues come down in my hometown in New Orleans, statues of P.G.T. Beauregard, Jefferson Davis, Robert E. Lee. And I was watching these statues come down, and I was thinking about what it meant that I grew up in a majority Black city in which there were more homages to enslavers than there were to enslaved people. And what are the implications of that? What does it mean that to get to school, I had to go down Robert E. Lee Boulevard? To get to the grocery store, I had to go down Jefferson Davis Parkway? That my middle school was named after a leader of the Confederacy? That my parents still live on a street today, named after someone who owned over 150 enslaved people? Because the thing is, we know that symbols and names and iconography aren't just symbols. They're reflective of the stories that people tell. And those stories shape the narratives that communities carry. And those narratives shape public policy. And public policy shapes the material conditions of people's lives, which isn't to say that, you know, you just take down a 60-foot-tall statue of Robert E. Lee and you suddenly get rid of the racial wealth gap. But it does help us recognize the sort of ecosystem of ideas and stories and narratives that help us understand what's happened throughout American history and help us understand the ways that certain communities and certain groups of people have been disproportionately and intentionally harmed throughout American history. And so I was thinking about my city. I was thinking about New Orleans. I was thinking about how New Orleans was at one point the largest and busiest slave market in the country. And I had no idea about that growing up, right? And that I went past these statues of these men who literally fought a war predicated on maintaining and expanding the institution of slavery, maintaining and expanding, you know, bondage over my ancestors, and had no conception of, like, who they were. And so I started to ask a lot of questions like, well, how is the history of slavery being told and taught, not only in schools, but also through our public landscape, right? Through our monuments, through the memorials, through the museums, through the plaques and all of these things that shape the sort of landscape of again, iconography that we see. And I started in New Orleans and then kind of went across the country, visiting plantations, prisons, cemeteries, memorials, monuments, and try to get a real sense of, like, what are the places that are telling the story honestly? What are the places that are running from their responsibility to tell this story? And what are the places that are kind of doing something in between? And talking about, you know, Monticello was one of the first places I went. Yeah. And I wanted to go there because, you know, Jefferson is kind of like this microcosm. He's like this personification of the larger story of America, which is to say that America is a place that has provided unparalleled, unimaginable opportunities for millions of people across generations in ways that their ancestors could have never imagined. And it has also done so at the direct expense of millions and millions of other people who have been intergenerationally subjugated and oppressed. And both of those things are the story of America. It's not one over here or one over there. It's that you have to hold both of those realities alongside one another. And Jefferson is someone who sort of embodies that cognitive dissonance or those conflicts of interest, which is to say he is a person who wrote one of the most important documents in the history of the Western world and also enslaved over 600 people over the course of his lifetime, including four of his own children that he had by an enslaved woman on his plantation, Sally Hemings. He's someone who wrote in the Declaration of Independence that all men are created equal, and then wrote in his book Notes on the State of Virginia that Black people are likely inferior to whites in both endowments of body and mind, right? And so part of what I wanted to do when I went to these places was to get a sense of, like, well, how does a place like Monticello, which is responsible for communicating and conveying the legacy of Jefferson and the legacy of this land, are they telling a sort of two-dimensional story of Jefferson, the way that I was taught about Jefferson growing up as being this president, this intellectual hero, this great man, Or are they telling a more complicated and more honest story about who Jefferson was that takes seriously the fact that he was in many ways the intellectual founding father of this country, but also the fact that he was an enslaver, right? And separated families and had people beaten had a relationship when he was in his 40s with a teenage enslaved woman that bore several children, right? In ways that we can't understand as in any way other than being coerced, given that it's an enslaver and his enslaved property. So, yeah, it's kind of like me trying to go to all these places and get a sense of how these places tell the story of the history that happened on that land. And how do we understand, to your point, what happened then as compared to how we tell the story about what happened then now?
I mean, these conversations have been going at least way more in the mainstream alongside where sort of you kind of got the inspiration for this book right around that era where these statues are coming down and whatnot. I grew up in Newark, New Jersey. There's no connection with me with seeing sort of the ruins, if you will, or the markings of slavery outside of hearing about it in school. Christian and I in 2018 did an 8-city tour, part of which was in Virginia. We're driving from Richmond to Virginia Beach, and part of that was to drive through Charlottesville. And I was like, oh my God, those are the statues that are on the news. And then as we're driving, and I brought it up, and I think it surprised some of the people in the car with us that are from that area, that I was so drawn aback by it. And then we drove through an area where there's no buildings. And I was like, yo, why aren't there buildings over there? Like, I'm just being like a dude from the East Coast. I'm like, yo, that's, you should develop this area. It's like on the water. And then someone goes, well, you can't. That was the slave market. You're not allowed to build there. And I was just like, I mean, in my brain, the car crashed. That's how I was like, a what? Like, yeah, I've just never experienced it. And I think it made people uncomfortable because they're like, well, we're not like that. I'm like, I'm not saying you're like that. I'm just shocked that that's there.
Yeah.
You haven't grown up in the South. I don't know if this has become more apparent to you in your life or whatnot, but there is a strong, it feels like this fairly horrific but important part of our culture hasn't really, really been taught to the majority of Americans. In the same way, when I talk to someone from South Africa, they're like, oh no, we did a lot of soul searching and coming to terms with what we've done after the fall of apartheid. It feels like we never did that. Has that become more apparent to you in your life? Is do you think this book might help sort of bridge some of those gaps?
Yeah, I mean, a couple things. One, it's really fascinating to hear you talk about that, in part because, Virginia is absolutely, it was the center of the Confederacy, right? And it was a place that was central to the America in so many ways blossomed out of colonial Virginia, right? It kind of expanded from there. That was in so many ways, with Jamestown and everything, it was kind of the centerpiece of the American project, especially in its earliest days. And so it makes sense, given its history, that there's so many places. I mean, there's no place in Virginia that doesn't have a relationship to slavery, right? Like, that it is scarred into the landscape of that state on every single street, in every part of its soil, in every tree, everywhere. What's interesting, though, is that, like, there's a history of slavery in New Jersey. There's a history of slavery in New York, right? Like, New York City was at one point the second largest slave market in the country after Charleston. Mm-hmm. And so it's interesting to think about the ways that that history is, like, talked about and memorialized. And I don't know the extent to which, like, when you were growing up, that was a part of the discourse, right? Because I think for me growing up in the South, it was like slavery was this thing that happened in the South and didn't happen in the North. And sort of the sort of moral, the thing that undergirded that, that was kind of implicit within it, was like, oh, the North was the good guys and the South were the bad guys. And it's like, that doesn't fully account for the sort of complex way that slavery existed in different iterations all across America, right? Like, New York is not a place that that didn't have its own relationship to slavery. Even people were enslaved in New York, and even when people were no longer enslaved in New York after gradual emancipation, people in New York were the ones who, it was the banks in New York who financed slavery. It was the insurance companies in New York who provided the collateral. It was the political infrastructure of New York. In 1861, the mayor of New York City, Fernando Wood, proposed to the rest of the government, he said that we should secede from the Union alongside with South Carolina, Alabama, Virginia, all these states of the Confederacy, because their social and political interests were so deeply entwined and ingrained in the slaveocracy of the South. So it's fascinating because I think so many people who grow up in that region don't even have a sense of their own state's connection to this history in like a really profound way.
Yeah,
we really don't. All we were taught is if a slave made it past the border of the North, they were good.
Yeah.
Like, that's just literally all we were taught.
It was super chill when they got up here. You
know? Yeah, yeah, yeah. We're like, come on, dude. Everything was all good.
Yeah. Come play some PlayStation. Like,
that was one of my. Have you tried Latin food? Like, we're just waiting for them.
That was one of my favorite, or at least, like, very interesting parts about the book, about just the foundation of the American economy was really, really so tied to slavery. And, mm-hmm. and that part is really what is, you know, definitely not really taught. But when you were giving the specifics about insurance companies and banks that are very much still around today that built their wealth on slavery and still have records of slaves being transferred to other people or other banks, and you realize, like, you know, we think of these you know, giant corporations and especially insurance companies, you just think like, oh, they've always existed in our lives and mm-hmm. they've always been big. And then when I'm reading your book, I'm like, man, that's how they got so influential and powerful. Yeah. Just on human capital.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And I think to your point about the economy, I mean, it's hard to overstate the extent to which the bodies and the work of enslaved people made the United States a global economic superpower. In 1860, the 4 million enslaved black people in this country were worth more than every bank, factory, and railroad combined, right? Like, worth more than all the manufacturing in this country combined were the bodies of enslaved people the year before the Civil War began. So this was not like a sort of peripheral part of the American economy. This is like what made the American economy go. And it's what in many ways contributed to the global economy, right? Because America is this becoming the central trading hub for the rest of the world. And so many of the things that are being traded, even if they are not directly produced by enslaved people, they are part of the sort of domestic ecosystem of trade that is impossible to have without the work of enslaved folks.
Look, I'm glad that I think these conversations are starting to be had, and it all falls into like people talking about critical race theory and trying to be more transparent and honest, especially about the shame that this country holds, because I think it's an opportunity to move forward in a very positive way. I do want to connect this to soccer in one way. In obviously the World Cup is coming up. It is in Qatar, and there people.
And nothing's gone wrong with this. There's been
completely innocuous, benign.
I can't figure out how you're going to connect this to slavery, actually, Christian.
But I want to just get maybe your perception of what, you know, all the stories you're hearing about. You know, people are calling it modern day slavery of what happens. In Qatar and how these stadiums get built, and there's a lot of people doing the work to kind of have those conversations. Grant Wall already started a piece where he was interviewing workers at the hotels that work at the World Cup, that are housing people for the World Cup, and some of them are like, you know, they say this is, you know, that they have a terrible experience. They don't enjoy coming to work. And then some say like, hey, it sucks, but this is what I have to do. I have to give my passport to my employer, or, you know, yeah, it's difficult to move from job to job, but, you know, I have to take care of my country, you know, back in Thailand or back in India and stuff like that. So what are your thoughts when you think about such a global sporting event being connected to things like this?
Yeah, it's I'm so glad that Grant wrote that piece, and Grant's such a, you know, the soccer world is lucky to have, you know, a journalist like Grant who I think really digs into the complexities of something like that and doesn't allow it to be, it's not, you know, in his piece, it's clearly, as you point to, like, it's not a black and white kind of thing, right? Like, there's a lot of texture and nuance that has to be teased out. You know, I think what can be true, and this speaks to the workers in Qatar, but also workers generally around the world, is that, like, it can be true that one really needs a job in order to get money to send back to their families. And it can be true that someone is grateful to have a job that gives them money for themselves and for their families. That in and of itself does not mean that you have not also been exploited, right? Like, that in and of itself does not also mean that you have not been taken advantage of. That in and of itself does not also mean that you are in working in an environment that represents, like, a potentially fatal threat to you and your life. And so I think we talked about with Jefferson, like, holding multiple truths. I think with, you know, workers in Qatar, like, that's also a thing that we have to hold, that some of them may both be grateful for the job, and also that doesn't mean that the things that are exploitative and violent and dangerous about it aren't still there. I mean, we see this throughout so many countries across the world. We see that in, you know, there in America is not immune to that by any means. There's definitely jobs where that in which that's the case, you know, here as well. So, you know, it does become a sort of, like, morally tricky enterprise to try to, like, all right, how do I ethically navigate, like, how to think about and talk about the World Cup? And I don't mean this as a, like, well, fuck it, like, whatever, but I don't know what it means to watch any FIFA sponsored event and not right, feel right. like some sort of, like, right, you know, right. Oh man, like, you know, there's it's such a corrupt organization. There's bribes everywhere. There's, like, people taking money out of this pot and putting it in that pot, or putting it in their pockets. Or, you know, we just had the 2018 World Cup in Russia. Right. And people are like, I had no idea that Vladimir Putin was this kind of person. Like, Vladimir Putin's been the same person for the last however many, mm-hmm. you know, so like, it's not as if this is the first time that FIFA has, like, placed spectators in a position where we're, like, watching something that we also feel kind of icky about. But, like, you know, and you try to say, like, I have these values, but at the same time, I really want to watch the World Cup, or I really want to travel here, but this place has laws in place that are, like, run counter to any notion of justice that I believe in, right? And I think there are a lot of places like that, and I think the most important thing to do is to be is just to name it, right? And so and just to say, like, this is for people to name, in the same way that people we're talking about, you know, what it meant, like, to be an LGBTQ person in Russia wasn't better in 2018 than it is now. But you have to, but there were people who were like, this is, you know, but at once enjoying the World Cup and also saying, like, this isn't right. And I think it's got to be the same thing with Qatar. But it is, the whole thing is just strange, man. It's in the winter, and then I'm sure y'all saw that sign of, like, all the things that weren't allowed.
Right.
It's bizarre.
It's ridiculous.
Everything that's fun and you can enjoy about life was on that sign.
Right. Yeah. Truly. It was like, you turned it around, I was like, no hot pockets. Or I'm like, no pancakes. Damn. No joy.
Really? Yeah, you're going to take Pop-Tarts from me? It's the only Truly. Joy I have.
Truly. You can only have the plain Pop-Tarts.
But you are allowed vuvuzelas, which is like, why are we keeping the bad things?
That's the one thing getting rid of all the fun banned. Things.
Yes.
Okay. A couple quick things.
But you are also a soccer fan. You're also a big Arsenal fan.
That's
How
what
do
I was
going to so
get
far
to.
About the season.
Gunnar.
Mikel Arteta, the greatest Gunnar. Manager of all time.
I believe in the trust the process, baby.
Have you been Arteta in this whole time?
I've not been explicitly Arteta out.
Okay. Been, all right.
You're not true.
We'll get proof of this.
You're
from
not
the group
on
chat.
Arsenal Fan TV screaming. All right.
I'm not on Arsenal Fan TV. No.
Honestly, Clint Smith on Arsenal Fan TV would blow everybody's mind, bro. They would be like,
it would be pretty wild.
There'll be a calming.
I mean, what you'd be saying would be more well thought out than anything else. I've been on Arsenal Fan
TV. Calming presence.
I was just riffing, you know?
Oh, man. I mean, this season's been unbelievable. I'm tired. Like, Aaron will tell you that, like, every year, with the exception of last year where we lost our first three games and didn't score a goal. But every other year, they give you the thing, you know, Arsenal fans know, they give you that little bit of hope. You're like, this is going to be the year. This is going to be the season. I feel it. This is going to be. And then I say it in the group chat, and Aaron is like, shut up. Stop jinxing it. Don't say anything. I'm tired of you. As if I am to blame for the downfall of us, having been a mid.
Can I tell you something? I'm not in the group chat. But now I'm going to blame you for when our season falls apart, bro.
Truly. I'm trying to keep it. So I haven't said it. I just do eye emojis after we win. That's all. That's what I just send some eye emojis. Okay. I'm like, okay, you know, let's see. It's, you know, I became an Arsenal fan. I'm actually writing a piece about this now for The Atlantic. I watched the 1998 World Cup when I was 10 years old. And like many black kids playing soccer in the 90s in the United States, I was the only black kid on my soccer team. And I was watching France play, and they had this guy, this 20-year-old, Thierry Henry. And I was watching them play, and he scored this beautiful goal in like the 90th minute against South Africa, I think in their first game. And I hadn't watched a lot of soccer up to that point. I just remember I had a grilled cheese sandwich and was like sitting in front of the TV and, you know, was caught the end of the game, and it was such a beautiful goal. And also I was like, oh, he looks like me. And I was so like, I didn't have the language, I don't think, to sort of like tease that out when I was 10, but I was so drawn to him as a player. And so drawn to the fact that like we shared a complexion in a sport in which so few people shared my complexion. And I was watching France versus South Africa, which is like black people all over the place, right?
Yeah.
It was like just Emmanuel Petit, who was the only white person on the field, basically.
Yeah.
and so then I followed Henri's career, and then he ended up at Arsenal. And my mom went to a conference for work in London, I think that next year. And she was in a car, in a cab, and she was like, oh, my kid loves soccer. I'm trying to bring him back a soccer jersey because apparently they like soccer in England or whatever. And she asked the cabbie, and she was like, hey, like, I'm trying to get my son a soccer jersey. And I think he was like upset that she said soccer, but she was like, I'm trying to get him a jersey. What's the soccer team in London? And she's saying this because she's used to American sports where it's like each city has a team, right?
Right, right.
And so she doesn't know that London has 223 teams. But the cabbie was clearly
you're
Arsenal
in one
fan.
Right now in this cab. This is cab FC.
I'm the manager.
Yeah, right. We're in the 17th division.
Truly, we play Wrexham next week.
Hurry up, get your boots on.
And he was like, ma'am, there's only one football team in London, and that's Arsenal. And so she was like, great, now I'm going to get an Arsenal jersey, the team in London. And she brought back a jersey, and then it just kind of, you know, Henri and the Arsenal jersey, I think it just solidified it. And I just have been a Arsenal fan throughout. Those early days were amazing. I mean, I was a fan, and then like 2 years later, we were invincible and we were undefeated. Yeah. And I was like, oh, every season's going to be like this.
I made
amazing.
The right decision.
Yo, this is great.
I'm glad I picked the one team in London.
Right. I'm glad I picked the one team in London. It's like not knowing anything about football and being like, I like the color of the Patriots uniforms.
Right,
those seem nice.
Yeah.
You know, in the Tom Brady era. Yeah. And so, I love that team. I love the history of that club. I love what Arsene Wenger did. I love, you know, I think a few weeks ago they celebrated that moment where they had Arsenal was the first team to have 9 black players start a match at the same time, which was more than had ever existed in the Premier League. And that team, you know, so I think that was also a huge part of it. And then over the last few years, you know, I mean, the last several years have been rough. And it's interesting cause I remember Wenger left how long ago? 3-4 years now?
2016,
17, 16, yeah. 17, something like that.
man, I remember being like, I'm so tired of third place finishes. Like, we should be competing for the title. I'm so sick of these so second and third place
fourth
finishes.
Fourth place was a trophy. Now I'm like, I need a fourth place trophy right now.
I'm an Everton fan. So third place would be, I want a parade for third place.
Truly. Truly. Oh, man. It's wild. You know, they tell you you never appreciate what you have until it's gone. But this might, you know, this is the year. I'm wary. It's still early. We're, what, like 10 games in? But they look good, man. They look
good. Yeah, they do.
Good. They very much do. Yeah, look.
It's exciting times.
I remember reading, I read Arsene Wenger's book, and he has a very, you know, because what's the joke, Alexis? Like, Arsene Wenger.
Oh, Wenger. They say Wenger's a genius, but he's the only one who knew you were allowed to sign black players.
Right. That's when you hear him talk about it in the book, it's like, it's just like common sense. He's like, the common sense was that he wasn't racist. He was just like, yeah, these guys are good. I'm gonna try to pick up some of these players. So he had the foresight.
Yeah, bring in players that are good. You know,
what a concept.
Right, right. Yeah. But so absolutely fascinating, man. Clint, we have to get you back on, man, because there's too much that we didn't talk about, and you're welcome back anytime, man. But this is
when you write that book about Arsenal. You definitely want to have you back on.
There
you
we won. Go.
You need any quotes from us? We got you.
Yeah. I'll write the forward in crayon. Let's go. That's
so funny.
Clint Smith, is there anything specific you want to let people know about? You know, obviously they can find the book everywhere, but is there anything you got that you're looking forward to, you want to let people know about? Feel free to take the floor is yours.
The Atlantic, where I'm a writer, is doing a World Cup newsletter. So we'll have a World Cup newsletter coming out, I think every day during the World Cup. So keep a lookout for that. For me, I got a new book coming out in March of next year. It's a collection of poetry. So I write poetry. And it's about like fatherhood. I got a 5-year-old and a 3-year-old who we didn't have time to talk about this, but I brought them to the Arsenal game in Baltimore a couple months ago during the summer.
Oh, we were there.
And, we were there.
Were you there?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Snap. But like, it's wild because my kids, like, we have, you know, the Premier League is on all the time in the background on the weekends. And I think my kids, before this, they would be like, I'm so tired of soccer being on TV all the time. Put on Daniel Tiger. Put on Bluey. Like, what are we doing?
Gracie's Corner, you know?
Gracie's Corner, you know?
I'm trying to jam Alma's right now,
Way. and then I took them to the game in August. And, like, it completely transformed their relationship to both soccer and Arsenal. Like, my son is 5 years old. And he left that day. He was like, this was the best day ever, right? And it's just, wow. I mean, I think because it became so much more real to them. They were like, oh, this isn't just a thing that's on the screen. Like, there are real people who are like, and like, you know, he saw Bukayo Saka score in front of him, right? And so now it's like not just the person on dad's jersey. It's like, oh, this is a real person. And he had his hot dog and she had her chicken nuggets and they were screaming and dancing and and it reminded me of like when my dad used to take me to New Orleans Saints games when I was a kid. And it's like, I loved the Saints so much when I was a kid. And, you know, now that I'm adult, I'm like, how much of it was the Saints and how much of it was like, this was this time I spent with my dad.
Yeah.
And it ends up being fused together, right? And that your love for the sport is also tied to the community that you're a part of as you like engage with it. But it's been wild because now my son just like runs around screaming like Gabriel Martinelli, you know, on weekends. He's like Martinelli, and so it's been cool. And like they both have their little Arsenal jerseys. My wife now like is much more. She watched the All or Nothing documentary, and I think she mostly watches because she thinks Mikel Arteta is like the handsomest man on earth. And I was like, you know, that is the one person I'll accept you thinking he's more handsome than me.
Yeah, it's fine.
But I had
a good hairline until he got on TV.
Man, and the permanent 5 o'clock shadow just looking like he's a handsome man. I can't deny it. But now it's cool because like post documentary, post Arsenal game, like I feel like my family's on board in a way they weren't before. So Shout out to preseason U.S. games, man.
No, really, dude.
Yeah, it's
great.
Huge.
Yeah, yeah. We got a
dude. Your son's gonna be 7 years old on Arsenal Fan TV, being like,
right.
He's like, why is my son yelling Obama blood clot young? I'm like, why? Where'd he get this from?
Oh man,
he ain't even on the team no more, man. That's great.
Clint, this has been so cool, and maybe for the next book, if you want to come back on the show, you're more than welcome. This has been super cool. Absolutely honored to have you on the show. Everybody, make sure you follow Clint on social media. I know you're big on Twitter.
At Clint Smith the third.
So go for it. Clint, seriously, absolutely honored. Great meeting you, and thank you so much for doing this.
Appreciate y'all. This was a lot of fun.
Yo, shouts to Clint Smith. Thank you so much for joining us. This has been our opening episode for the Cooligans World Cup Daily. There's plenty of other shows, you know. There's plenty of World Cup shows, a lot of soccer shows, but there's not other ones where two comedians are hosting them. So if you want to enjoy the World Cup and laugh a little bit, add some levity to everything that's going on, please join us. We will be with you every single match day. So, subscribe to the Cooligans podcast. You can subscribe on YouTube, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, and wherever you get your podcast. But we will be with you throughout the World Cup. So if you're listening to this, you had a good time, let your friends know, hey, these two comics, they host this hilarious show. I laugh so much. I peed myself. I pooped myself. A little, maybe a mixture of the two. Okay.
Nice little cocktail you got going on there.
Okay.
But no, if you're wondering, like, hey, man, this was. Yeah, if you're wondering, like, yo, this was such a good time. I wonder when the next one is. It's tomorrow. We're going to be with you every day, basically.
Okay.
So come on.
Through. We won't be. Thanksgiving, we won't be around because, our families are haters, bro. Hey, they hate our success. They don't want to see us thrive.
Damn, bro. They don't want to see us win. You know what? It be your own people.
For real. All right. So we will be back tomorrow. We will see you. Thank you again for joining us. Again, shout out to Clint Smith. Make sure you follow him at Clint Smith III. Clint Smith, III on
Twitter. Hey, and if you're in Atlanta, come hang out with us at Park Tavern. We will be doing a free watch along for USA versus Wales. Doors open at noon, I believe. So come out, check that out. Park Tavern in Atlanta. Party with the Cooligans, baby!
Let's go. All right, we'll see you tomorrow, everybody. Peace.
Now's the time to start your next adventure behind the wheel of an exciting new Toyota hybrid. With the largest lineup of hybrid, plug-in hybrid, and electrified vehicles to choose from, Toyota has the one for you. Every new Toyota hybrid comes with Toyota Care 2-year complimentary scheduled maintenance, an exclusive hybrid battery warranty, and Toyota's legendary quality and reliability. Visit your local Toyota dealer today. Toyota, let's go places. See your local Toyota dealer for hybrid battery warranty details.